could be strengthened by postulating encryption, if need be. In the story as told, we can agree that it is bizarre that the scientists never thought of checking to see if there was an ASCII translation of the bit streams running through the wire. How could they be so dense? Fair enough. Send the whole gadget, boxes A and B and the connecting wire, to Mars. And let the alien scientists there try to figure out the regularity. The fact that all A's cause reds, all B's cause greens, and random bit strings cause ambers will be just as visible to them as to us. But they will be clueless about ASCII. To them, this gift from outer space will exhibit an utterly mysterious regularity, totally beyond all analytic probes, unless they hit upon the idea that each box contains a description of a world, and that the descriptions are of the same world. It is the fact that each box bears multifarious semantic relationships to the same things, though expressed in different terminology and differently axiomatized, that grounds the regularity. When I tried this thought experiment out on Danny Hillis, creator of the connection machine, he thought immediately of a cryptographic solution to the puzzle, and then granted that my solution could be profitably viewed as a special case of his solution. Al and Bo were using the world as a one-time pad, an apt allusion to a standard technique of encryption. You can see the point by imagining a variation. You and your best friend are about to be captured by hostile forces, who may know English, but not much about your world. You both know Morse code, and hit upon the following impromptu encryption scheme. For a dash, speak a truth. For a dot, speak a falsehood. Your captors are permitted to listen to you two speak. Birds lay eggs, and toads fly. Chicago is a city, and my feet are not made of tin, and baseball is played in August. You say, answering, no, dash dot, dash dash dash, to whatever your friend has just asked. Even if your captors know Morse code, unless they can determine the truth and falsity of these sentences, they cannot detect the properties that stand for dot and dash. This variation could be added to our fable for spice as follows. Instead of shipping the computer systems in the boxes to Mars, we put Al and Bo in the boxes and ship them to Mars. The Martians will be as puzzled by them if they play the Morse code prank as by the computers. Unless they draw the conclusion, obvious to us, but we're not Martians, that these things in the boxes are to be semantically interpreted. The point of the fable is simple. There is no substitute for the intentional stance. Either you adopt it and explain the pattern by finding the semantic level facts, or you will forever be baffled by the regularity, the causal regularity, that is manifestly there. The same moral we have seen can be drawn about interpreting the historical facts of evolutionary history. Even if you can describe, in matchless micro detail, every causal fact in the history of every giraffe who has ever lived, unless you go up a level or two and ask why, hunting for the reasons endorsed by Mother Nature, you will never be able to explain the manifest regularities. Such as the fact that giraffes have come to have long necks, for instance. That is Dewey's point in the quotation given earlier in this chapter. At this juncture, if you are like many philosophers, you are attracted by the claim that this thought experiment works only because boxes A and B are artifacts whose intentionality, such as it is entirely derived and artifactual. The data structures in their memories get their references, if they get any at all, from indirect reliance on the sense organs, life histories, and purposes of their creators, Al and Bo. The real source of the meaning or truth or semanticity in the artifacts lies in these human artificers. That was the point of the suggestion that in a certain sense Al and Beau were in their respective boxes. Now, I might have told the story differently. Inside the boxes were two robots, Al and Beau, which had each spent a longish lifetime scurrying around in the world, gathering facts before getting in their respective boxes. I chose a simpler route to forestall all the questions about whether Box A or Box B was really thinking. But we may now reinstate the issues thereby finessed, since it is finally time to dispose once and for all of the hunch that original intentionality could not emerge in any artifactual mind without the intervention of a human artificer. Suppose that is so. Suppose, in other words, that whatever differences there might be between a simple box of truths, like Box A, and the fanciest imaginable robot, since both would just be artifacts, neither could have real or original intentionality, but only the derivative intentionality borrowed from its creator. Now you are ready for another thought experiment, a reductio ad absurdum of that supposition. 4. Safe passage to the future. Suppose you decided, for whatever reasons, that you wanted to experience life in the 25th century. And suppose that the only known way of keeping your body alive that long required it to be placed in a hibernation device of sorts. Let's suppose it's a cryogenic chamber that cools your body down to a few degrees above absolute zero. In this chamber, your body would be able to rest, suspended in a super coma, for as long as you liked. You could arrange to climb into the chamber and its surrounding support capsule, be put to sleep, and then automatically be awakened and released in 2401. This is a time-honored science fiction theme, of course. Designing the capsule itself is not your only engineering problem, since the capsule must be protected and supplied with the requisite energy for refrigeration, etc., for over 400 years. You will not be able to count on your children and grandchildren for this stewardship, of course, since they will be long dead before the year 2401, and you would be most unwise to presume that your more distant descendants, if any, will take a lively interest in your well-being. So you must design a super system to protect your capsule and to provide the energy it needs for 400 years. Here, there are two basic strategies you might follow. On one, you should prospect around for the ideal location, as best you can foresee, for a fixed installation that will be well supplied with water, sunlight, and whatever else your capsule and the super system itself will need for the duration. The main drawback to such an installation or plant is that it cannot be moved if harm comes its way, if, say, someone decides to build a freeway right where it is located. The alternative strategy is much more sophisticated and expensive, but avoids this drawback. Design a mobile facility to house your capsule, along with the requisite sensors and early warning devices, so that it can move out of harm's way and seek out new sources of energy and repair materials as it needs them. In short, build a giant robot and install the capsule with you inside it, in it. These two basic strategies are copied from nature. They correspond roughly to the division between plants and animals. Since the latter, more sophisticated strategy better fits our purposes, let's suppose that you decide to build a robot to house your capsule. You should try to design this robot so that above all else it chooses actions designed to further your interests, of course. Don't call these mere switching points in your robot's control system choice points if you think that this would imply that the robot had free will or consciousness, for I don't mean to smuggle any such contraband into the thought experiment. My point is uncontroversial. The power of any computer program lies in its capacity to execute branching instructions, zigging one way or another, depending on some test it executes on the data then available to it, and my point is just that. As you plan your robot's control system, you would be wise to try to structure it so that whenever branching opportunities confront it, it will tend to branch down that path that has the highest probability of serving your interests. You are, after all, the raison d'etre of the whole gadget. The idea of designing hardware and software that are specifically attuned to the interests of a particular human individual is not even science fiction anymore, though the particular design problems facing your robot builders would be profoundly difficult engineering challenges, somewhat beyond the state of the art today. This mobile entity would need a vision system to guide its locomotion, and other sensory systems as well, in addition to the self-monitoring capacities to inform it of its needs. Since you will be comatose throughout and thus cannot stay awake to guide and plan its strategies, you will have to design the robot supersystem to generate its own plans in response to changing circumstances over the centuries. It must know how to seek out and recognize and then exploit energy sources, how to move to safer territory, how to anticipate and then avoid dangers. With so much to be done, and done fast, you had best rely whenever you can on economies. Give your robot no more discriminatory prowess than it will probably need in order to distinguish whatever needs distinguishing in the world, given its particular constitution. Your task would be made much more difficult if you couldn't count on your robots being the only such robot around with such a mission. Let us suppose that, in addition to whatever people and other animals are up and about during the centuries to come, there will be other robots, many different robots, and perhaps plants as well, competing with your robot for energy and safety. Why might such a fad catch on? Let's suppose we get irrefutable advance evidence that travelers from another galaxy will arrive on our planet in 2401. I, for one, would ache to be around to meet them, and if cold storage was my only prospect, I'd be tempted to go for it. If you have to plan for dealing with other robotic agents, acting on behalf of other clients like yourself, you would be wise to design your robot with enough sophistication in its control system to permit it to calculate the likely benefits and risks of cooperating with other robots, or of forming alliances for mutual benefit. You would be most unwise to suppose that other clients will be enamored of the rule of live and let live. There may well be inexpensive parasite robots out there, for instance, just waiting to pounce on your expensive contraption and exploit it. Any calculations your robot makes about these threats and opportunities would have to be quick and dirty. There is no foolproof way of telling friends from foes or traitors from promise keepers. So you will have to design your robot to be, like a chess player, a decision maker who takes risks in order to respond to time pressure. The result of this design project would be a robot capable of exhibiting self-control of a high order. Since you must cede fine-grained real-time control to it once you put yourself to sleep, you will be as remote as the engineers in Houston were when they gave the Viking spacecraft its autonomy. Listen to Chapter 12. As an autonomous agent, it will be capable of deriving its own subsidiary goals from its assessment of its current state and the import of that state for its ultimate goal, which is to preserve you till 2401. These secondary goals, which will respond to circumstances you cannot predict in detail, if you could, you could hardwire the best responses to them, make the robot far afield on century-long projects, some of which may be ill-advised, in spite of your best efforts. Your robot may embark on actions antithetical to your purposes, even suicidal, having been convinced by another robot, perhaps, to subordinate its own life mission to some other. This robot we have imagined will be richly engaged in its world and its projects, always driven ultimately by whatever remains of the goal states that you set up for it at the time you entered the capsule. All the preferences it will ever have will be the offspring of the preferences you initially endowed it with, in hopes that they would carry you into the 25th century. But that is no guarantee that actions taken in the light of the robot's descendant preferences will continue to be responsive directly to your best interests. From your selfish point of view, that is what you hope. But this robot's projects are out of your direct control until you are awakened. It will have some internal representation of its currently highest goals, its summum bonum. But if it has fallen among persuasive companions of the sort we have imagined, the iron grip of the engineering that initially designed it will be jeopardized. It will still be an artifact, still acting only as its engineering permits it to act, but following a set of desiderata partly of its own devising. Still, according to the assumption we decided to explore, this robot will not exhibit anything but derived intentionality, since it is just an artifact, created to serve your interests. We might call this position client-centrism with regard to the robot. I am the original source of all the derived meaning within my robot, however far afield it drifts. It is just a survival machine designed to carry me safely into the future. The fact that it is now engaged strenuously in projects that are only remotely connected with my interests, and even antithetical to them, does not, according to our assumption, endow any of its control states or its sensory or perceptual states with genuine intentionality. If you still want to insist on this client-centrism, then you should be ready to draw the further conclusion that you yourself never enjoy any states with original intentionality, since you are just a survival machine designed originally for the purpose of preserving your genes until they can replicate. Our intentionality is derived, after all, from the intentionality of our selfish genes. They are the unmeant meaners, not us. If this position does not appeal to you, consider jumping the other way. Acknowledge that a fancy enough artifact, something along the lines of these imagined robots, can exhibit real intentionality, given its rich functional embedding in the environment and its prowess at self-protection and self-control. It, like you, owes its very existence to a project, the goal of which was to create a survival machine. But it, like you, has taken on a certain autonomy, has become a locus of self-control and self-determination, not by any miracle, but just by confronting problems during its own lifetime and, more or less, solving them. Problems of survival presented to it by the world. Simpler survival machines, plants, for instance, never achieve the heights of self-redefinition made possible by the complexities of your robot. Considering them just as survival machines for their comatose inhabitants leaves no patterns in their behavior unexplained. If you pursue this avenue, which of course I recommend, then you must abandon Searle and Fodor's principled objection to strong AI. The imagined robot, however difficult or unlikely an engineering feat, is not an impossibility, nor do they claim it to be. They concede the possibility of such a robot, but just dispute its metaphysical status. However adroitly it managed its affairs, they say, its intentionality would not be the real thing. That's cutting it mighty fine. I recommend abandoning such a forlorn disclaimer and acknowledging that the meaning such a robot would discover in its world and exploit in its own communications with others would be exactly as real as the meaning you enjoy. Then your selfish genes can be seen to be the original source of your intentionality, and hence of every meaning you can ever contemplate or conjure up, even though you can then transcend your genes using your experience, and in particular the culture you imbibe, to build an almost entirely independent or transcendent locus of meaning, on the base your genes have provided. I find this an entirely congenial, indeed inspiring, resolution of the tension between the fact that I, as a person, consider myself to be a source of meaning, an arbiter of what matters and why, and the fact that at the same time I am a member of the species Homo sapiens, a product of several billion years of non-miraculous R&D, enjoying no feature that didn't spring from the same set of processes one way or another. I know that others find this vision so shocking that they turn with renewed eagerness to the conviction that somewhere, somehow, there just has to be a blockade against Darwinism and AI. I have tried to demonstrate that Darwin's dangerous idea carries the implication that there is no such blockade. It follows from the truth of Darwinism that you and I are Mother Nature's artifacts. But our intentionality is nonetheless real for being an effect of millions of years of mindless algorithmic R&D instead of a gift from on high. Jerry Fodor may joke about the preposterous idea of our being Mother Nature's artifacts, but the laughter rings hollow. The only alternative views posit one skyhook or another. The shock of this conclusion may be enough to make you more sympathetic to Chomsky's or Searle's forlorn attempts to conceal the mind behind impenetrable mystery, or Gould's forlorn attempts to escape from the implication that natural selection is all it takes, an algorithmic series of cranes cranking out ever higher forms of design. Or it may inspire you to look elsewhere for a savior. Didn't the mathematician Kurt Gödel prove a great theorem that demonstrated the impossibility of AI? Many have thought so. And recently their hunch was given a powerful boost by one of the world's most eminent physicists and mathematicians, Roger Penrose, in his book, The Emperor's New Mind, Concerning Computers, Minds, and the Laws of Physics, 1989, to which the next chapter is devoted. Chapter 14, Real Meaning, the sort of meaning our words and ideas have, is itself an emergent product of originally meaningless processes, the algorithmic processes that have created the entire biosphere, ourselves included. A robot designed as a survival machine for you would, like you, owe its existence to a project of R&D with other, ulterior ends. But this would not prevent it from being an autonomous creator of meanings, in the fullest sense. Chapter 15, one more influential source of skepticism about AI and Darwin's dangerous idea, must be considered and neutralized. The persistently popular idea to the effect that Gödel's theorem proves that AI is impossible. Roger Penrose has recently revived this meme, which thrives in darkness, and his exposition of it is so clear that it amounts to exposure. We can exapt his artifact to our own purposes. With his unintended help, this meme can be extinguished. Chapter 15, The Emperor's New Mind and Other Fables. 1. The Sword in the Stone. In other words, then, if a machine is expected to be infallible, it cannot also be intelligent. There are several theorems which say almost exactly that. But these theorems say nothing about how much intelligence may be displayed if a machine makes no pretense at infallibility. Alan Turing, 1946, page 124. The attempts over the years to use Gödel's theorem to prove something important about the nature of the human mind have an elusive atmosphere of romance. There is something strangely thrilling about the prospect of using science to such an effect. I think I can put my finger on it. The key text is not the Hans Christian Andersen tale about the emperor's new clothes, but the Arthurian romance of the Sword in the Stone. Somebody, our hero, of course, has a special, perhaps even magical, property which is quite invisible under most circumstances, but which can be made to reveal itself quite unmistakably in special circumstances. If you can pull the sword from the stone, you have the property. If you can't, you don't. This is a feat or a failure that everyone can see. It doesn't require any special interpretation or special pleading on one's own behalf. Pull out the sword and you win, hands down. What Gödel's theorem promises the romantically inclined is a similarly dramatic proof of the specialness of the human mind. Gödel's theorem defines a deed, it seems, that a genuine human mind can perform, but that no imposter, no mere algorithm-controlled robot could perform. The technical details of Gödel's proof itself need not concern us. No mathematician doubts its soundness. The controversy all lies in how to harness the theorem to prove anything about the nature of the mind. The weakness in any such argument must come at the crucial empirical step, the step where we look to see our heroes, ourselves, our mathematicians, doing the thing that the robot simply cannot do. Is the feat in question, like pulling the sword from the stone, a feat that has no plausible lookalikes? Or is it a feat that cannot readily, if at all, be distinguished from mere approximations of the feat? That is the crucial question. And there has been a lot of confusion about just what the distinguishing feat is. Some of the confusion can be blamed on Kurt Gödel himself, for he thought that he had proved that the human mind must be a skyhook. In 1931, Gödel, a young mathematician at the University of Vienna, published his proof, one of the most important and surprisingly mathematical results of the 20th century, establishing an absolute limit on mathematical proof that is really quite shocking. Recall the Euclidean geometry you studied in high school, in which you learned to create formal proofs of theorems of geometry. From a basic list of axioms and definitions, using a fixed list of inference rules, you were learning your way around in an axiomatization of plane geometry. Remember how the teacher would draw a geometric diagram on the blackboard, showing a triangle, say, with various straight lines intersecting its sides in various ways, meeting at various angles, and then ask you such questions as, do these two lines have to intersect at a right angle? Is this triangle over here congruent to that triangle over there? Often the answer was obvious. You could just see that the lines had to intersect at a right angle, that the triangles were congruent. But it was another matter, in fact a considerable amount of inspired drudgery, to prove it from the axioms, formally, according to the strict rules. Did you ever wonder, when the teacher put a new diagram on the blackboard, whether there might be facts about plane geometry that you could see were true but couldn't prove, not in a million years? Or did it seem obvious to you that, if you yourself were unable to devise a proof of some candidate geometric truth, this would just be a sign of your own personal frailty? Perhaps you thought, there has to be a proof, since it's true, even if I myself can never find it. That's an intensely plausible opinion. But what Gödel proved beyond any doubt is that when it comes to axiomatizing simple arithmetic, not plain geometry, there are truths that we can see to be true, but that can never be formally proved to be true. Actually, this claim must be carefully hedged. For any particular axiom system that is consistent, not subtly self-contradictory, a disqualifying flaw, there must be a sentence of arithmetic, now known as the Gödel sentence of that system, that is not provable within the system but is true. In fact, there must be many such true sentences, but what one is all we need to make the point. We can change systems, and prove that first Gödel sentence in the next axiom system we choose. But it, in turn, will spawn its own Gödel sentence, if it is consistent, and so on forever. No single, consistent axiomatization of arithmetic can prove all the truths of arithmetic. This might not seem to matter very much, since we seldom, if ever, want to prove facts of arithmetic. We just take arithmetic for granted without proof. But it is possible to devise Euclid-type axiom systems for arithmetic, Peano's axioms, for instance, and prove such simple truths as 2 plus 2 equals 4. Such obvious middle-level truths as numbers evenly divisible by 10 are also evenly divisible by 2, and such unobvious truths as there is no largest prime number. Before Gödel devised his proof, the goal of deriving all mathematical truth from a single set of axioms was widely regarded by mathematicians and logicians as their great project, difficult, but within reach. The moon landing or human genome project of the mathematics of the day. But it absolutely can't be done. That is what Gödel's theorem establishes. Now, what does this have to do with artificial intelligence or evolution? Gödel proved his theorem some years before the invention of the electronic computer. But then Alan Turing came along and extended the implications of that abstract theorem by showing, in effect, that any formal proof procedure of the sort covered by Gödel's theorem is equivalent to a computer program. Gödel had devised a way of putting all possible axiom systems in alphabetical order. In fact, they can all be lined up in the Library of Babel, and Turing then showed that this set was a subset of another set in the Library of Babel, the set of all possible computers. It doesn't matter what material you make a computer out of. What matters is the algorithm it runs. And since every algorithm is finitely specifiable, it is possible to devise a uniform language for uniquely describing each algorithm and putting all the specifications in alphabetical order. Turing devised just such a system. And in it, every computer, from your laptop to the grandest parallel supercomputer that will ever be built, has a unique description as what we now call a Turing machine. The Turing machines can each be given a unique identification number, its Library of Babel number, if you like. Gödel's theorem can then be reinterpreted to say that each of those Turing machines that happens to be a consistent algorithm for proving truths of arithmetic, and not surprisingly, these are a vast but vanishing subset of all the possible Turing machines, has associated with it a Gödel sentence, a truth of arithmetic it cannot prove. So that is what Gödel, anchored by Turing to the world of computers, tells us. Every computer that is a consistent truth of arithmetic prover has an Achilles heel, a truth it can never prove, even if it runs till doomsday. But so what? Gödel himself thought that the implication of his theorem was that human beings, at least the mathematicians among us, cannot then be just machines, because they can do things no machine could do. More pointedly, at least some part of such a human being cannot be a mere machine, or even a huge collection of gadgets. If hearts are pumping machines, and lungs are air-exchanging machines, and brains are computing machines, then mathematicians' minds cannot be their brains, Gödel thought, since mathematicians' minds can do something that no mere computing machine can do. What exactly can they do? This is the problem of defining the feat for the big empirical test. It is tempting to think we have already seen an example. They can do what you used to do when you looked at the blackboard in geometry class, using something like intuition or judgment or pure understanding. They can just see that certain propositions of arithmetic are true. The idea would be that they don't need to rely on grubby algorithms to generate their mathematical knowledge, since they have a talent for grasping mathematical truth that transcends algorithmic processes altogether. Remember that an algorithm is a recipe that can be followed by servile dunces, or even machines. No understanding is required. Clever mathematicians seem, in contrast, to be able to use their understanding to go beyond what such mechanical dunces can do. But although this seems to be what Gödel himself thought, and it certainly expresses the general popular understanding of what Gödel's theorem shows, it is much harder to demonstrate than first appears. How can we distinguish a case of somebody or something grasping the truth of a mathematical sentence from a case of somebody or something just wildly guessing correctly, for instance? You could train a parrot to utter true and false when various symbols were written on the blackboard in front of it. How many correct guesses without an error would the parrot have to make for us to be justified in believing that the parrot had an immaterial mind after all? Or perhaps was just a human mathematician in a parrot costume? Hofstadter, 1979. This is the problem that has always given fits to those who want to use Gödel's theorem to prove that our minds are skyhooks, not just boring old cranes. It won't do to say that mathematicians, unlike machines, can prove any truth of arithmetic. For if what we mean by prove is what Gödel means by prove in his proof, then Gödel shows that human beings, or angels if such there be, cannot do it either. Dennett, 1970. There is no formal proof of a system's Gödel sentence within the system. A famous early attempt to harness Gödel's theorem was by the philosopher J.R. Lucas, 1961, see also 1970, who decided to define the crucial feat as producing as true a certain sentence, some Gödel sentence or other. This definition runs into insoluble problems of interpretation, however, ruining the sword-in-the-stone definitiveness of the empirical side of the argument. Dennett, 1970, 1972. See also Hofstadter, 1979. We can see more clearly what the problem is by considering several related facts, real and imaginary. René Descartes, in 1637, asked himself how one could tell a genuine human being from any machine, and he came up with two very certain means. The first is that they, the machines, could never use words, or put together other signs as we do in order to declare our thoughts to others. For we can certainly conceive of a machine so constructed that it utters words, and even utters words which correspond to bodily actions causing a change in its organs. For example, if you touch it in one spot, it asks what you want of it, but if you touch it in another, it cries out that you are hurting it, and so on. But it is not conceivable that such a machine should produce different arrangements of words so as to give an appropriately meaningful answer to whatever is said in its presence, as the dullest of men can do. Secondly, even though such machines might do some things as well as we do them, or perhaps even better, they would inevitably fail in others, which would reveal that they were acting not through understanding, but only from the disposition of their organs. For whereas reason is a universal instrument which can be used in all kinds of situations, these organs need some particular disposition for each particular action. Hence it is, for all practical purposes, impossible for a machine to have enough different organs to make it act in all the contingencies of life in the way in which our reason makes us act. Descartes, 1637, Part 5. Alan Turing, in 1950, asked himself the same question and came up with just the same acid test, somewhat more rigorously described, what he called the imitation game, and what we now call the Turing test. Put two contestants, one human, one a computer, in boxes, in effect, and conduct conversations with each. If the computer can convince you it is the human being, it wins the imitation game. Turing's verdict, however, was strikingly different from Descartes'. I believe that in about 50 years' time, it will be possible to program computers with a storage capacity of about 10 to the 9th power to make them play the imitation game so well that an average interrogator will not have more than a 70% chance of making the right identification after 5 minutes of questioning. The original question, "Can machines think?" I believe to be too meaningless to deserve discussion. Nevertheless, I believe that at the end of the century, the use of words and general educated opinion will have altered so much that one will be able to speak of machines thinking without expecting to be contradicted. Turing, 1950, page 435. Turing has already been proven right about his last prophecy. The use of words and general educated opinion has already altered so much that one can speak of machines thinking without expecting to be contradicted. On general principles, Descartes found the notion of a thinking machine inconceivable, and even if, as many today believe, no machine will ever succeed in passing the Turing test, almost no one today would claim that the very idea is inconceivable. Perhaps this sea change in public opinion has been helped along by the computer's progress on other feats, such as playing checkers and chess. In an address in 1957, Herbert Simon and Newell, 1958, predicted that a computer would be the world chess champion in less than a decade, a classic case of over-optimism, as it turns out. A few years later, the philosopher, Hubert Dreyfus, 1965, predicted that no computer would ever be able to play good chess, since playing chess required insight. But he himself was soon trounced at chess by a computer program, an occasion for much glee among AI researchers. Art Samuel's checkers program has been followed by literally hundreds of chess-playing programs, which now compete in tournaments against both human and other computer contestants, and will probably soon be able to beat the best human chess players in the world. But is chess playing a suitable sword-in-the-stone test? Dreyfus may once have thought so, and he has a distinguished predecessor, Edgar Allan Poe of all people, whose certainty on this score drove him to unmask one of the great hoaxes of the 19th century, von Kempelen's chess automaton. In the 18th century, the great Vaucanson had made mechanical marvels that entranced the nobility and other paying customers by exhibiting behaviors that even today inspire our skepticism. Could Vaucanson's clockwork duck really do what it is reported to have done? When corn was thrown down before it, the duck stretched out its neck to pick it up, swallowed and digested it. Poe, 1836a, page 1255. Other ingenious artificers and tricksters had followed in Vaucanson's wake, developing the art of mechanical simulacra to such a high pitch that one of them, Baron von Kempelen, in 1769, could exploit public fascination with such devices by creating a deliberate tease, a purported automaton that could play chess. Von Kempelen's original machine passed into the hands of Johann Nepomuk Mälzel, who made some improvements and revisions, and then caused quite a stir in the early 19th century by exhibiting Mälzel's chess machine, never quite guaranteeing that it was just a machine, and surrounding the whole performance, for which he charged a pretty penny, with enough of the standard magician's ostentations to arouse anybody's suspicions. An obviously mechanical swami figure sat at a suspiciously enclosed cabinet, the doors and drawers of which were sequentially opened, but never all at once, permitting the audience to see that there was nothing but machinery inside. The swami figure then commenced to play a game of chess, picking up and moving the chess pieces on a board in response to the moves of a human opponent, and usually winning. But was there, literally, a homunculus inside, a little man doing all the mind work. If AI is possible, the cabinet could be filled with some collection or other of cranes and other bits of machinery. If AI is impossible, then there must be a skyhook in the cabinet, a mind pretending to be a machine. Poe was absolutely certain that Meltzel's machine concealed a human being, and his ingenious sleuthing confirmed his suspicions, which he described in detail with an appropriate air of triumph in an article in the Southern Literary Messenger, 1836A. At least as interesting as his reasoning about how the hoax was perpetrated is his reasoning, in a letter accompanying the publication of his article, about why it had to be a hoax. A line of argument that perfectly echoes John Locke's proof, back in Chapter 1. We have never at any time given assent to the prevailing opinion that human agency is not employed by Mr. Meltzel. That such agency is employed cannot be questioned, unless it may be satisfactorily demonstrated that man is capable to impart intellect to matter. For mind is no less requisite in the operations of the game of chess than it is in the prosecution of a chain of abstract reasoning. We recommend those whose credulity has in this instance been taken captive by plausible appearance, and all, whether credulous or not, who admire an ingenious train of inductive reasoning, to read this article attentively. Each and all must arise from its perusal convinced that a mere machine cannot bring into requisition the intellect which this intricate game demands. Poe, 1836b, page 89. We know that, however convincing this argument used to be, its back has been broken by Darwin, and the particular conclusion Poe drew about chess has been definitively refuted by the generation of artificers following in Art Samuel's footsteps. What, though, of Descartes' test, now known as the Turing test? That has generated controversy ever since Turing proposed his nicely operationalized version of it, and has even led to a series of real, if restricted, competitions, which confirm what everybody who had thought carefully about the Turing test already knew. Dennett, 1985. It is embarrassingly easy to fool the naive judges, and astronomically difficult to fool the expert judges. A problem, once more, of not having a proper sword in the stone feet to settle the issue. Holding a conversation or winning a chess match is not a suitable feat. The former because it is too open-ended for a contestant to secure unambiguous victory in spite of its severe difficulty, and the latter because it is demonstrably within the power of a machine after all. Might the implications of Gödel's theorem provide a better contest? Suppose we put a mathematician in box A and a computer, any computer you like, in box B, and ask each of them questions about the truth and falsehood of sentences of arithmetic. Would this be a test that would surely unmask the machine? The trouble is that human mathematicians all make mistakes, and Gödel's theorem offers no verdict at all about the likelihood, let alone impossibility, of less than perfect truth detection by an algorithm. It does not appear, then, that there is any fair arithmetic test we can put to the boxes that will clearly distinguish the man from the machine. This difficulty has been widely seen as systematically blocking any argument from Gödel's theorem to the impossibility of AI. Certainly everybody in AI has always known about Gödel's theorem, and they have all continued unworried with their labors. In fact, Hofstadter's classic, Gödel-Escherbach, 1979, can be read as the demonstration that Gödel is an unwilling champion of AI, providing essential insights about the paths to follow to strong AI, not showing the futility of the field, but Roger Penrose, Rose Ball Professor of Mathematics at Oxford, and one of the world's leading mathematical physicists, thinks otherwise. His challenge has to be taken seriously, even if, as I and others in AI are convinced, he is making a fairly simple mistake. When Penrose's book appeared, I pointed out the problem in a review. His argument is highly convoluted and bristling with details of physics and mathematics. And it is unlikely that such an enterprise would succumb to a single crashing oversight on the part of its creator, that the argument could be refuted by any simple observation. So I am reluctant to credit my observation that Penrose seems to make a fairly elementary error right at the beginning, and at any rate fails to notice or rebut what seems to be an obvious objection. Dennett, 1989b. My surprise and disbelief were soon echoed, first by the usual assortment of commentators to a target article based on his book, by Penrose in Behavioral and Brain Sciences, and then by Penrose in turn. In The Non-Algorithmic Mind, 1990, Penrose's reply to his critics, he expressed mild astonishment at the strong language some of them used. Quite fallacious, wrong, lethal flaw, and inexplicable mistake, invalid, deeply flawed. The AI community was, not surprisingly, united in its dismissal of Penrose's argument. But in Penrose's eyes, they didn't agree on what the lethal flaw was. This was itself a measure of how widely he had missed the mark, since the critics had found many different ways of zeroing in on one big misunderstanding about the very nature of AI and its use of algorithms. 2. The Library of Toshiba. The people who are going to like the book best, however, will probably be those who don't understand it. As an evolutionary biologist, I have learned over the years that most people do not want to see themselves as lumbering robots programmed to ensure the survival of their genes. I don't think they will want to see themselves as digital computers either. To be told by someone with impeccable scientific credentials that they are nothing of the kind can only be pleasing. John Maynard Smith, 1990, Review of Penrose. Consider the set of all Turing machines, in other words, the set of all possible algorithms. Or rather, to ease the task of imagination, consider instead a vast but finite subset of them, relativized to a particular language, and consisting of volumes of a particular length. The set of all possible strings of 0 and 1, bit strings, up to the length of 1 megabyte, 8 million zeros and ones. Consider the reader of these strings to be my old laptop computer, a Toshiba T1200, with its 20 megabyte hard disk. We'll prohibit using any additional memory, just for finiteness' sake. It should come as no surprise that the vast majority of these bit strings do nothing at all worth mentioning if an attempt is made to run them as programs on the Toshiba. Programs, after all, are not random strings of bits, but highly designed sequences of bits, the products of thousands of hours of R&D. The fanciest program that ever could be is still something that can be expressed as one or another string of zeros and ones. And although my old Toshiba is too small to run some of the truly huge programs that have been devised, it is quite capable of running a handsome and representative subset of them. Word processors, spreadsheets, chess players, artificial life simulations, logic proof checkers, and yes, even a few automatic arithmetic truth provers. Call any such runnable program, actual or envisaged, an interesting program. It is roughly analogous to a readable book, actual or imaginary, in the Library of Babel, or a viable genotype in the Library of Mendel. We don't have to worry about the boundary separating the interesting from the uninteresting. When in doubt, throw it out. No matter how we rule, there are vastly many interesting programs in the Library of Toshiba. But they are vanishingly hard to find. That's why software companies make quite a few millionaires along with their software. Now, Every megabyte-length bitstring is an algorithm in one sense, the sense that matters to us. It is a recipe, stupid or wise, that can be followed by a mechanism, my Toshiba. If we try bit strings at random, most of the time the Toshiba will just sit there emitting a faint hum. It won't even flash an amber light. There are vastly more ways of being a dead program than a live one, to echo Dawkins. Only a vanishing subset of these algorithms are interesting in any way at all, and only a vanishing subset of them have anything at all to do with truths of arithmetic. And only a vanishing subset of these attempt to generate formal proofs of arithmetical truths. And only a vanishing subset of those are consistent. Gödel shows us that not a single one of the algorithms in that subset, and there are still vastly many of them, even for my little Toshiba, can generate proofs of all the truths of arithmetic. But Gödel's theorem tells us nothing at all about any other algorithm in the library of Toshiba. It does not tell us whether there are any algorithms that can play decent chess. There are, in fact, vastly many, and a few actual ones reside on my actual Toshiba, and I've never beaten any of them. It does not tell us whether there are any algorithms that are pretty darn good at playing the Turing test or imitation game. In fact, there is one actual one on my Toshiba, a stripped-down version of Joseph Weizenbaum's famous ELISA program, and I have seen it fool uninitiated people into concluding, like Edgar Allan Poe, that there must be a human being issuing the answers. At first, I was baffled by how any sane human being could think there was a tiny guy in my laptop Toshiba, sitting, unattached to anything, on a card table. But I had forgotten how resourceful a persuaded mind can be. There must be, these wily skeptics concluded, a cellular phone in my Toshiba. Gödel's theorem in particular has nothing at all to tell us about whether there might be algorithms in the library of Toshiba that could do an impressive job of producing as true or detecting as true or false candidate sentences of arithmetic. If human mathematicians can do an impressive job of just seeing with mathematical intuition that certain propositions are true, perhaps a computer can imitate this talent, the same way it can imitate chess playing and conversation holding. Imperfectly, but impressively. That is exactly what people in AI believe, that there are risky, heuristic algorithms for human intelligence in general, just as there are for playing good checkers and good chess and a thousand other tasks. And here is where Penrose made his big mistake. He ignored this set of possible algorithms, the only set of algorithms that AI has ever concerned itself with, and concentrated on the set of algorithms that Gödel's theorem actually tells us something about. Mathematicians, Penrose says, use mathematical insight to see that a certain proposition follows from the soundness of a certain system. He then goes to some length to argue that there could be no algorithm, or at any rate no practical algorithm, for mathematical insight. But in going to all this trouble, he overlooks the possibility that some algorithm, many different algorithms in fact, might yield mathematical insight even though that was not just what it was for. We can see the mistake clearly in a parallel argument. Chess is a finite game, since there are rules for terminating go-nowhere games as draws. That means that there is, in principle, an algorithm for determining either checkmate or a draw. I have no idea which. In fact, I can specify the algorithm for you quite simply. 1. Draw the entire decision tree of all possible chess games, a vast but finite number. 2. Go to the end node of each game. It will be either a win for white or black or a draw. 3. Color the node black, white, or gray depending on the outcome. 4. Work backwards one whole step, one white move plus one black move at a time. If on the previous move all the paths from any one of white's moves lead through all black's responses to a white-colored node, color that node white, and move back again, and so forth. Do the same for any guaranteed winning paths for black. Color all other nodes gray. At the end of this procedure, way past the universe's bedtime, you will have colored in every node of the tree of all possible chess games, leading back to white's opening move. Now it is time to play. If any one of the 20 legal moves is colored white, take it. There is a guaranteed checkmate ahead that can be reached just by always staying on the white nodes. Shun any black move, of course, since that opens up a guaranteed win for your opponent. If there are no white moves at the outset, choose a gray move, and hope that sometime later in the game you'll be offered a white move. The worst you can do is a draw. If all the opening moves for white are colored black, most improbably, your only hope is to choose one at random and hope that your opponent, playing black, goofs at some later stage of play and lets you escape by getting on a gray or a white path. That is an algorithm, clearly. No step in the recipe requires any insight, and I have specified it unambiguously in a finite form. The trouble is that it is not remotely feasible or practical because the tree it exhaustively searches is vast. But I suppose it is nice to know that in principle there is an algorithm for playing perfect chess, however useless. There might be a feasible algorithm for playing perfect chess. No one has ever found one, thank goodness, since it would turn chess into a game of scarcely more interest than tic-tac-toe. No one knows whether there is such a feasible algorithm, but the general consensus is that it is very unlikely. Not knowing for sure, let's choose the supposition that makes for the worst case for AI. Let's suppose that there is no feasible algorithm for checkmate or a guaranteed draw. None at all. Does it follow that no algorithm running on my Toshiba can achieve checkmate? Hardly. As I have already confessed, the chess algorithms on my Toshiba are undefeated in play against one human being, me. I'm not very good, but I expect I have about as much insight as the next human being. Someday I might beat my machine if I practiced a lot and worked very hard, but the programs on my Toshiba are trivial compared with the current champion chess programs. About them, you could safely bet your life that they would checkmate me, though not Bobby Fischer, every time. I don't recommend to anyone that you actually bet your life on the relative excellence of these algorithms. I might improve, and I wouldn't want your death on my conscience. But in fact, if Darwinism is right, you and your ancestors have an unbroken string of successful gambles for similarly fatal stakes on the algorithms embodied in your machinery. That is what organisms have done every day since life began. They have bet their lives at the algorithms that built them and that operate within them if they are among the lucky organisms with brains, will keep them alive long enough to have children. Mother Nature has never aspired to absolute certainty. A good risk is enough for her. So we would expect that if mathematicians' brains are running algorithms, they would be algorithms that happen to do pretty well in the truth-detecting department, without being foolproof. The chess algorithms on my Toshiba, like all algorithms, yield guaranteed results. But what they are guaranteed to do is not checkmate me, but just play legal chess. That is all they are for. Of the vast number of algorithms guaranteed to play legal chess, some are much better than others, though none is guaranteed a win against any other. At least this is not the sort of thing one would hope to prove mathematically, even if, as a matter of brute mathematical fact, the initial state of program X and program Y were such that X would win all possible games against Y. This means that the following argument is fallacious. X is excellent at achieving checkmate. There is no practical algorithm for checkmate in chess. Therefore, the explanation of X's talent cannot be that X is running an algorithm. The conclusion is obviously false. The algorithm level of explanation is exactly the right level at which to explain the power of my Toshiba to beat me at chess. It's not as if it had particularly potent electricity running through it, or a secret reservoir of élan vital inside its plastic case. What makes it better than other chess-playing computers, I can beat the really simple ones, is that it has a better algorithm. What kind of algorithms, then, might mathematicians be running? Algorithms for trying to stay alive. As we saw in our consideration of the survival machine robots in the last chapter, such algorithms would have to be capable of indefinitely resourceful discrimination and planning. They must be good at recognizing food and shelter, telling friend from foe, learning to discriminate harbingers of spring as harbingers of spring, telling good arguments from bad, and even, as a sort of bonus talent thrown in, recognizing mathematical truths as mathematical truths. Of course, such Darwinian algorithms, Cosmides and Tooby, 1989, wouldn't have been designed just for this special purpose, any more than our eyes were designed for telling italics from boldface. But that doesn't mean that they aren't superbly sensitive to such differences if given a chance to consider them. Now, how could Penrose have overlooked this retrospectively obvious possibility? He is a mathematician, and mathematicians are primarily interested in that vanishing subset of algorithms that they can prove, mathematically, to have mathematically interesting powers. I call this the God's eye view of algorithms. It is analogous to the God's eye view of volumes in the Library of Babel. We can prove, for what it's worth, that there is a single volume in the Library of Babel that lists, in perfect alphabetical order, all the telephone subscribers in New York City whose net worth on January 10, 1994 was more than $1 million. There has to be. There couldn't be that many millionaire phone owners in New York, and so some one of the possible volumes in the library must list them all.